Welcome to the Sandra Kubik podcast. I believe conversations with humans are key to understand machines. I've developed this podcast to help myself paint the bigger picture of the large language model space while sharing with you lessons from the most interesting humans I meet along the way. This is a safe space for you and me to poke and ponder. Shall we? Welcome back, everybody. Today's conversation is one that I've been really looking forward to ever since I came back from an engineer world's fair. I have never seen a place filled with people having such hands-on experience when it comes to LLM implementations in production pipelines, at scale, in enterprises, in big organizations that are handling a lot of data, a lot of workflows. Today, I'm talking to Swix, who is known to many as an influencer. He's very active on Twitter. He has a podcast with Alessio called Latent Space. You'll find there huge, huge amount of information when it comes to the research, benchmarks, when it comes to the use cases people have, when it comes to hiring, super informative resource. We're also talking about what it's like to build a moat as a startup these days, as an AI startup, as an AI engineer, who an AI engineer persona is these days. We're also talking about his latest venture, building a popular newsletter, AI News. I can tell you, many of my friends have already subscribed to it, so you should also not sleep on that too. And we're talking about AI Engineer World's Fair, which is another project of Swix, a conference that really brings together people from around the world that are really deeply entrenched in the AI engineering systems these days. Thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow my journey on all socials at It's Sandra Kubik. It really helps me a lot to know how I'm doing here. So if you could rate the podcast on YouTube or on whatever platform you're tuning in, that would be super helpful. And if you find this conversation useful, please share it with a friend to help me grow. Other than that, let's get down to it. Whenever you give a talk or whenever you are writing about the ecosystem, you are able to capture what's going on in very crisp terms and in very fun terms as well. Okay. And I've seen you.
That is mostly, yeah, entertaining myself.
Well, it's entertaining for the audience as well, I feel like. So thanks for doing this. I feel entertained anyway.
Thanks.
Really excited to talk to you today. I know we're going to talk about AI space in general, about the progress that's happening in the space, multiple ventures that you embarked on, and what you're currently into. I want to start with an update on AI engineer as a persona. So you wrote this essay, The Rise of AI Engineer, which captured the zeitgeist at the time where there was this new type of job needed or soon to be needed in the market, because AI models are changing, its nature is changing, the way to interact with them is changing. And LLMs created this new layer of abstraction and an entire profession, it seems. It's still early days of this shift that you've talked about in your essay. I am curious, what are some of the things that you see a lot of confusion about, even though that term is catching on and even though it seems like the industry is really adopting this job description and the fact that this new persona is really needed right now?
What are people... thanks. I think that's an accurate reflection of where things have gone. I think basically for me, I was just in the right time, right place to make this observation because I had seen similar transitions in related fields, particularly in front-end engineering, cloud or sort of DevOps engineering and data engineering. And then when I saw this wave in the AI/LLM space, I was like, oh, I've seen this before. and that's why I was like relatively safe for me to not only write that essay, but also to effectively go all in on this idea because I knew that it was coming. I think the perception or challenge that people are trying to face now is how much of the ML engineer skill set is you know, required in AI engineering, and how much AI engineering is net new, I guess, is the way that I would phrase it. And then maybe a little bit about, like, you know, how do we hire, and also how do we generate sustainable moats? Because, you know, we put the hiring portion aside. Sustainable moats is really the source of all the downstream impact. So for example, like, if you worry about your, you know, what is the job description, like, you know, what is the property of ML engineers, what is the property of AI engineers, all of that doesn't matter if you're not making money, and all of that also doesn't matter if you're making a lot of money. So really, it's just all of, like, you know, are you making money or not? And money solves a lot of problems. Product market fit also solves a lot of problems. And I think, you know, one thing that is increasingly of the moment right now is people have a lot of questioning. There's a lot of investment going into models, a lot of investment going into AI infrastructure. And, you know, the revenue has been good for some companies, but it needs to be a lot more for the investment to pay off, right? So we are in a phase of the hype cycle where the entire world has seriously overinvested as far as current revenue is concerned. And we've seen this exactly before in the internet bubble. Long-term, this is going to pay out. When I say long-term, on the scale of 10 to 30 years. But in the short term, between, like, you know, the next 2 to 5 years, we need some of this to pay off, or there will be a significant reduction in investment because we've invested a lot already. So that's kind of where I'm at, in the sense of, you know, people are debating this terminology of, you know, what is or is not the AI engineer. And I think the AI engineer is whatever you need to make money.
So that makes a lot of sense. I've looked at the Latent Space episode where you and your guests from Elicit were tackling the how to hire AI engineer, James Brady and Adam Wiggins. And so you've been talking about the type of mindset to adapt, and it really sounded quite universal, if I may say so. So background in software engineering in general, but generally just curiosity and interest in this new emerging way of interaction with LLMs and bigger AI models and the layers around it. It sounds like you kind of need to be this Swiss knife type of person that is really curious about things and is not afraid to jump into the new environment and figure things out as you go.
I think so, but so not just about, I would say that curiosity is just the starting point. Like, you need to be curious. Like, we talked about that in that episode. But personally, I would also encourage applying that curiosity towards something, right? So to me, that my term for that is creativity, that you can come up with, like, a new capability comes out from Cohere, and you are able to turn that into a product that Cohere cannot even think about. But because you are well-versed in your customers' problems, then you can try to figure out, like, how to apply it. And that sort of, curiosity is just the learning piece. And then you also need the creativity in applying.
So you also mentioned that there are, so to say, natural laws for engineers, meaning things like context windows, the awareness of the fact that the context windows are increasing and what it means for building the products, as well as models becoming kind of a commodity and the cost of intelligence generally going really down. Would you say that if you're starting from the software engineer position and you're really excited about this field, really looking at it and starting to hack, going to hackathons, going to events, trying to build your new things, and having the right mindset, that's kind of the recipe to get into the space? Or there are some, like, hard requirements when it comes to the type of frameworks you want to be using, or generally how the ecosystem works, how these different models and apps interact with each other?
I don't think anything is required right now apart from building your own projects, because the market share of the leading framework. So LangChain and Llama Index are the two leading frameworks. They're not high. A lot of people try them out and then stop using them for whatever reason, whether they disagree in some elements or they find that they want a lighter abstraction. And then in terms of hackathons, you also don't need to go to hackathons at all to be a leading AI engineer. Some of them do, some of them don't. It really doesn't matter. It's more about, can you ship an interesting product that everyone else is gets everyone else excited? And some of the best AI engineers I know, not even in San Francisco, right? Like, they're all over the world. They're shipping really cool projects. And I think hackathons are just a forcing function for you to do something if you normally, don't have a lot of motivation, or you just want a team, right? And you want a competitive environment for you to show that you can sort of win in the in a sort of judging environment. I think the main requirement is just like have something interesting that you want to build and solve your own problems, or solve your customers' problems at work, and try to apply it there, because then you are really forced to come into contact with all these hard practical problems of prompt engineering, of context windows, of RAG, and the hallucinations of models, all the nasty stuff that people have to deal with when deploying these models into a real product. I think that you only get experience by, going through it and deploying to a real product. I think, and then just finally on the thing about natural laws, that comment was mostly just to point out that some things are worth doing even if they don't make sense today. In the sense that, like, I think a lot about like the leading or the most impressive products, like Devin from Cognition, which also spoke at the conference. Like, they are definitely losing or setting on fire a lot of money calling the GPT-4 API. And like, that's fine, because the cost of that is going to come down 90% over the next year, right? And that's just the normal state of affairs. Like, the whatever set level of intelligence, let's just say you benchmark it by MMLU, like a 85 or 90 in MMLU costs whatever, 50 cents per token today, is going to come down to 5 cents, in the next 1 to 2 years. That's a pretty reliable optimization, just from model distillation or improvements in whatever data sets that we have. I think, like, it's worth it. It's worth building ahead of where we are today, building things that don't make sense today, because they will make sense eventually, is my point. I think cost is just one element, though. There's also speed. We're definitely seeing a lot of interest in increasing the inference speed, right? From like 100 tokens per second to 500 tokens per second. We're starting to see the first few people do 1,000 tokens per second now. So what does it look like when you have 5,000 tokens per second, right? Like, that is something that I've been told that Grok is aiming towards. I don't know how economical that will be, but if you want speed, we will potentially 10x the sort of 500 tokens per second that Grok is already doing. So that's very exciting. So yeah, there's all these elements in terms of, like, when you are an AI engineer at the cutting edge of AI, you're getting experience, you're getting involved in the industry, you're building projects, and you have to just take the extra thing that normal software engineers don't have to take into account, but AI engineers do, is the pace of AI. And just observing the current trends, I think, is important to factor into your calculations of what is not feasible.
Right. So let's talk about the pace of AI and also other ugly things associated with it. So I've seen you and your guest call it this monster or wild horse. I've seen you comparing it to the desert worm from Dune.
Desert worm. Okay. Yes. All right. Yeah, you saw the talk. All right.
yes, I saw it. So let's unpack why it's such a monstrous thing and why you're really embarking on a epic hero's journey when you're embarking on working with AI models in the cutting edge today. So far from just chatting to people and trying to understand how you're thinking about this, or the ecosystem you're creating is thinking about this. I know that high latency is a problem. I know that unpredictability of their responses is a problem, and also on kind of like the format of their responses and the content, but also of the semantics of these responses, even when you nail the format, kind of. On top of that, the pace is crazy and you have a monster that is growing heads all the time with new capabilities, new upgrades. Every time a big company announces something new, there's an entire team probably within a lot of organizations wrapping their head around how does it fit into their product and what does it mean moving forward. Would you add anything to this in terms of the monstrous qualities of AI?
Monstrous is mostly referring to just the sheer uninterpretability, I guess, of models. You know, with all these billions of parameters, we don't really know what's in them. And also, it's almost like the research scientists that train the models also don't know what they're capable of. And it's partially down to the engineers and the other people using the models to figure out what the properties of the models are after the training is done, because the training and the model capabilities are increasingly starting to separate a little bit. In classical ML, you train a model to do a task, and that there's very strict sort of one-to-one correlation. But when you train a foundation model, there is a plurality of tasks that it's doing. And sometimes some tasks might emerge that you don't even know it's aware, that you don't even know is there. Obviously, you try to tune the data set and your loss to optimize for a certain task, but some other tasks might emerge and you might not even know about it. So I think that is an element of emergence that I think maybe, I think it's well known and understood now, but it's still definitely part of the job of the engineer to figure that out, tease that out, and maybe harness it. So I kind of use that Dune metaphor for talking about that. Like, you know, there's a such powerful beast that is so much bigger than we can comprehend, but if we can learn to ride it and, you know, utilize it in useful ways that maybe the beast doesn't even think about or wasn't originally designed for, then we can use it to improve our life condition. And I think that's what engineering is, really, like just taking advantage of like nature, the rules of nature, laws of nature, and then, you know, using it to improve humanity.
That's a really nice way of looking at things. I've also noticed that you contrasted with these two widely recognized movements. One, on the one side, you have effective altruism, on the other, effective accelerationalism.
I just say EAC.
EAC, for a shortcut.
Yeah.
Both of these have been there for a while. Both of these have quite, I would say, strong, devoted crowds going one way or the other. You kind of put a engineer as a persona and their mission beyond that. And I think it's on purpose just to kind of try to shift the perspective from thinking about how we are going to approach the future one way or another, and thinking of focusing on what's the most kind of productive and pragmatic take on how you can approach what's already there, what's already happening, rather than kind of try to create projections about how it's going to evolve in the future. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. Also, I think this is just the silent majority of engineers that I talk to, how they feel about the safety versus acceleration movement, right? The EAC people have been very, very vocal and are just accelerationists all the time. And I think the EA people have been also very powerful and vocal in terms of the safety agenda that they've been pursuing. I find that AI engineers tend to be somewhere in between. Like, they are concerned about safety, but they're also they also want to accelerate AI because they see the benefits that, that they can bring to humanity. So we want to have like safe and responsible AI, but it's, you know, but the whole point is to harness this thing for public good or you know, commercial good, whatever that means. And I think like that practical element is something that is not as emphasized in EA and EAC. And I think that being a force or just staking our ground and saying like, okay, if, you know, where are you in that political spectrum of AI, EA versus EAC? Like we're in between, like we do want to accelerate. We are worried about safety. But above all, there's a horseshoe theory in a lot of politics where the two opposing philosophies tend to be similar to each other, which is that they tend to generate a lot of philosophical discussions and not be so concerned with practical implementation. And if engineering is anything, it's about practical implementation. So I would say, like, you know, to get away from the like weird, you know, AIE is between EA and EAC. You have to introduce a new dimension and just kind of introduce that horseshoe theory that says actually EA and EAC are very much the same thing, which is they're both on the more philosophical side of the spectrum and engineering is more on the practical side of the spectrum. And if you are biased towards action, then you should probably, you know, be interested in the engineering side of things.
Yeah, I definitely agree with this need of introducing the new dimension and also how the general vote among engineers is distributed when it comes to these different kind of takes on the AI progress and where we're heading. So it's really refreshing to see somebody voice it out finally. I wish there were more people just speaking those terms rather than, you know, asking on Twitter when AGI when.
When AGI, or, yeah. That's yeah, the most annoying question.
the prevalent question that captures people's imagination these days. When you say, I want to get back to this thing you said about the moat. So I am a builder interested in getting to this space. I hear you talking about creating moat around the product, and I want to understand how companies are doing that in order to, you know, do it myself or help somebody do that and learn the skills necessary in order to get there. What do I do? What's their accommodation?
If I knew, I would be very, very rich right now. But yeah, I mean, the simple answer is everyone's trying to figure it out. I'm not special. I don't have any particular expertise in here. I can speculate though, and I can say what I think and what I'm personally exploring. So, the problem here is basically that you are not, you know, just to start from the assumption that you are not a foundation model lab, right? So there's maybe five or six legitimate top tier foundation model labs. You can try to start one, but you know, you're going to need a whole lot of talent and capital that most people don't have. So assume the vast majority of AI engineers do not have that. And they still need to build a business that is cognizant or harnessing AI in some way. So effectively what we're talking about is how do you build, you know, an LLM wrapper and have a moat that, you know, someone else cannot just build tomorrow. I think it's very similar to other moats for that kind of business in a sense that really it's just understanding your customer a lot better than everyone else. And some part of that is going to be having your customer's data so that you can, let's just say, fine-tune your own custom models to serve your customer better than, you know, the sort of off-the-shelf models that you might get from the foundation model labs. So effectively, like, maybe your moat is developing vertical models. Maybe your moat is AI UX as well, which is the UX on top of the LLM, so that you can turn the modality from, like, function calling or, you know, text completion into something that is more intuitive, right? Like I'll just give concrete examples. You know, one of the most commonly cited examples right now is Harvey AI for lawyers. I mean, it's basically a sort of search engine and copilot for lawyers. And I think creative applications for non-technical people that have high like very high domain specificity in their needs that the foundation model labs will never really touch. I think that's a very ripe area for building moats, because you know, the deeper you understand your problem, like the harder it is to replicate your data or your products, you know, or implicit in products is your UX, and I think then you can keep going from there. There's a more formal analysis that people should think about, which is Hamilton-Helmer's seven powers framework, and that encompasses like talents and capital and brand and all that. But I think specifically for people building effectively LLM wrapper companies, it's going to be data, it's going to be products, or AI UX is what I call it. And yeah, I think those are the two main ones.
I love that. Sounds very approachable. So let's say I am in this vertical category. And what I'm hearing a lot out there is that people tend to really want to train their own fine-tuned version of a model on top of some base model coming from an AI lab, rather than use an API just for the purpose of creating some sort of moat around it. So trying to kind of leverage the data and combine it with the base to create that. Would you consider that a valuable viable option, or just one of many?
It's a viable option, but it should not be the first option. And a lot of people actually probably don't even need that option. You know, the precursor to fine-tuning your own model is RAG, right? I think a lot of people can get by on very, very good RAG, and probably, you know, you will always need RAG even if you have a fine-tuned model anyway, right? So I'm very pro RAG. I think that's that's aligned with what Cohere is doing anyway. And I think there's this spectrum between just adding a prompt to very, very basic RAG to maybe like some kind of knowledge graph RAG that seems to be super popular these days, and all the way to fine tuning a model for your own use cases. I definitely think fine tuning is all the way at the end, may not be worth it. Like there's increasingly people who have basically said they stopped fine tuning just because there's no point on top of just switching out models as they improve, as new models get shipped, and then just working on their RAG system. And I think that makes a ton of sense. So like, you don't get, like, your customer doesn't really care if the source of the improvements. They just care about the improvements, about your the end products or the end accuracy or precision of what you're shipping to them. And if it comes from fine tuning, good. If it comes from RAG, good. And it just happens that it's a lot easier to come from RAG. So all wish to say, like, all of this is just coming from stockpiling the best data, refining the best data for your customer anyway. So you might want to just work on that. And, you know, whether or not you fine tune or RAG, like, it doesn't really matter. That's just a deploy time choice. But like, the strategic thing to accumulate moat is to understand what is the most important data to have and to be the ultimate source of truth in your industry for that. And then you will do very well. I will say, like, you know, don't focus too much on that, because one way to, like, first you have to accumulate all that data. And I think that the kind of ML engineers that focus on saying, like, you know, stockpile data first, don't sufficiently question how to stockpile that data, because they just assume that the data falls from the sky. And I think people who are in startups and people who are in product understand that actually you have to work on the other side first, which is the product side, the sort of UX side, to give people something to give you their data, right? Like, so you need to build a nice storefront so that people will walk in and then start shopping at your store. And only after they start shopping at your store sufficiently, then you have the data to do anything that you want to do, right? But if you don't have a nice storefront, nobody's going to come in. And so what I mean by that is really, like, you have to have some creative or beautiful or like really good go-to-market product that actually gets people in the door for you to better understand your customer. So I think that sort of yin and yang of product versus the sort of customer data moat is very important.
Awesome. That sounds really good. So in terms of the skills necessary to build the RAG / fine-tuning / hybrid pipeline, and play with the prompts. You mentioned that one of the things that are still kind of floating around is the confusion about the amount of ML skills that are needed for that. I remember the graph, the beautiful graph you've created for your The Rise of AI Engineer essay with, we're going to pull it up on the screen for people that are watching, but for those that are listening, there are two arrows on a horizontal line. One is towards product user constraint type of jobs. The other is towards data and research constraint type of jobs. And there's an API line / model line in between those. And AI engineer is kind of in the middle between the product and the research side of things. So it seems like having ML background, having ML awareness, ML sensitivity does not hurt, on the contrary, but it's not required in order to build successful LLM pipelines these days.
Yeah, nothing else to say. I think you totally got it.
All right. Okay. Well, I think that's a really hopeful thing for people out there, because as you've mentioned, when it comes to the numbers, there are so many software engineers out there wondering about how the heck am I supposed to reposition myself in the market right now. And I guess the golden answer here will be always just play with the latest tools, play with the latest pipelines, see what you can build from there, and don't worry about having a PhD in, you know, maths, physics, and computer science.
Yeah, I think that's true. I would definitely support that. It's kind of weird that, you know, a lot of people, when they ask, you know, how do I get started in AI, they're still getting recommended, like, first you must read Attention Is All You Need, right? The original Transformers paper. And then you go and read it and you're like, okay, like, you know, like, I see the diagram that everyone uses, but like, how does this actually help me do anything interesting in AI? The answer is it doesn't. It really doesn't. Like, there's maybe like 7 other papers that you could read that are more recent, that are more current, that are more useful. But also, you don't even need to read those. Like, actually, you just need to read the docs of the of whatever LLM you're using. Some common knowledge about like how to prompt and productize these things. Then you're off to the races. You don't actually really need to read the papers. The papers do help in terms of foundational and historical understanding, so that you can be more creative, I guess, in how you ship products. I'm still trying to struggle, like, how the paper reading practice actually informs what we do. We do have a paper club in the Latent Space Discord that, you know, just every week we meet and read through papers. Some papers are more interesting than others, but everyone has like their own particular preference for like what to do. I would say, like, foundational knowledge, like, really important, but like the definition of foundational knowledge is moving over time. In fact, like, probably foundational knowledge for data engineering is more important for like just day-to-day job stuff. And then foundational knowledge for ML is more important for long-term fundamentals of like, okay, like here is how attention is shifting over time as we start to introduce like the normal stack of what a 2024 transformer looks like versus a 2017 transformer. So it's like always useful to know more, but like sometimes you don't need to do all that to get started.
You don't need that to block you from getting started. I would say, I would add to that coming from one of these AI labs, our attitude is very much, how do we turn this ML knowledge and package it in a way so that it's really usable for large groups of people? Bottom line, we want the models to be usable, and we want the models to be useful in people's workflows. And if having more advanced settings, more advanced features is a blocker because you get confused, because things get really messy when you start poking around not knowing what the hell you're doing, temperature being one example of that, then we simplify it. And I've noticed that over time, we've really made it easier and easier to build stuff. And I think it's definitely catering towards this group of people that is interested in the models but does not have traditional background, so to say, to get started.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the reasons why I felt like AI engineer was a good bet was because of this tendency of model labs to encourage this, right? Like it's in Cohere's interest to encourage people who don't really know, who don't have to know the internals of LLMs in order to use LLMs, right? So structurally, the number of AI engineers will grow because you guys, because OpenAI, because Anthropic, all of you want AI engineers to grow. Like they are your ideal customer. So like mathematically, I was like, oh, like I can see where this is all headed. So
wonderful. Well, thanks so much for voicing it out, because I think it made a lot of people do a sigh of relief. Like, okay, yes, this is, I'm kind of in the right frame of mind where just diving into the deep end doesn't really make sense, and I don't feel equipped or like it's necessary. But again, I want to play with this new technology, and I want to be useful in this kind of new technical shift that we're experiencing right now. So, speaking of your bets and a engineer persona, I've been to the World's Fair this year, which you've sadly missed in person because you've been there online. Thanks so much for putting it together. It was such an epic place. I feel like that was the best conference I've ever been to on AI, just because of this perfect mix of people that are really sort of focused on hands-on building and testing things. Some people that are researchy and some people that are just observing AI from the distance of their software engineer space they're at. And then you also have investors betting on how the future is going to play out. So I felt like it's a really good mix of people to kind of interact with and get a signal on where we're heading. Also when it comes to Cohere and the stuff we're shipping and how people are responding to it, I found it really useful to just chat about Command R Plus or hear people's stories of experimenting with it. Kudos to you for making it happen.
I'm curious. I mean, I'm curious, as an organizer, I always want to hear what it was like for you. Like, were there any particular conversations or things that you learn or any talks that you saw that like left a strong impression on you or maybe changed your mind in some way?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So number one thing that happened that typically doesn't happen for me because I have quite a social anxiety, oddly enough, being a DevRel and being a connector, is that I didn't go to any talks because I was hanging out with people and talking. So it was really effortless to bump into folks in the hallways or in the cafe or going to after parties. There were informal after parties and the formal after party, and just chat with people that way. The first very interesting thing that I observed was how people reacted to open weights for Command R Plus, and how
they loved them.
They loved them, and you know, coming from the shipping side of things, you see the numbers increasing, you see the activity around the company, how people talk about it is changing positively. But actually being there and hanging out with people, and I had a conversation about first food, and then it evolved into using Command R Plus because the person found out that I'm from Cohere, and they were using it as a personal productivity agent because they have a lot of screens, they're hyper ADD, and so they are using this agent to shut down the apps that are not currently used and looked at so that they can more focus on the workflow, the current workflow, without getting distracted looking at all this other shit that's going on. And so they were playing with it that way, but now they are interested at introducing it into their enterprise workflow because they just joined one company as a VP of Gen AI. And what they're thinking of is actually adopting it with a business license. So I was like, whoa, this is so interesting. Like, we've done this experiment where we released the weights for the model. We let the people look under the hood, run it locally without talking to us, without really necessarily interacting, which there is a lot of friction involved. I also don't like to interact with people when I use products. I just want to use product and see if it's useful and then move on. So that it actually helps to create the opinion about the model, about what it can do, and then move on in terms of the sales process almost and like business cycles. So you do still need a license, like a business license, in order to use it in production on a certain scale, but you don't have to interact with us in order to make up your mind about whether it's good or not, and you can just do whatever you want. So that was super useful. I shared it with the team. I felt like this really resonated really well. Another interesting thing was just hearing people's comments on models' tool use capabilities and how there isn't any clear contender when it comes to the models in terms of function calling, in terms of using different types of APIs, plugging into different calculator, whatnot tools. And that's also really relevant for us because this is an area where we heavily focus on, where we heavily invest, and in the future can expect just these capabilities get better and better. So a lot of things like that. But generally, honestly, aside from my day-to-day work, I just felt like I really need people that are interested in similar things, are having a take on it that's somewhat parallel almost to mine, and have a knowledge that I can tap into. And we can have an interesting conversation about, I don't know, whether you need embeddings or whether you need to experiment with Gen AI in your company in the first place, or whether you're having a keyword-based search is all right and you don't have to touch it because it's going to break. You know, like, you cannot have this conversation very often, just like generally out there. But I feel like this is the tribe of people that can have that. So it was really great.
Yeah. I hope to do it again. And I think I definitely feel like this tribe is only getting stronger. I'm worried that there are too many investors at the conference. I didn't really count, the percentage, but, you know, we're definitely trying to discourage too many investors, and we want to have more hands-on engineers. And then I think something that we tried this year that I think your colleague Vivek participated in was the leadership track, which we're trying for the first time to involve VPs of AI or, you know, any sort of more engineering leadership type of people. And I think AI engineering is starting, you know, we started the first conference last year. It started very much as like a bottoms up developer movement, but it's increasingly becoming also, you know, a top leadership concern for a lot of these companies. So we want to make sure that their needs are addressed as well. A lot of questions about hiring.
Yeah, I love that you had this track, and I know that you added it because there's a criticism that AI doesn't really happen in bigger organizations, but there was an entire track dedicated to AI in the
Fortune 500.
Yeah, I think that was an excellent thing. I learned so much from it as well because I had no idea about some of these companies going so deep. So that's really nice as well. I want to also ask you about another venture that you've recently started. You seem to be working on a bunch of things, and they're all somewhat interconnected. I feel like the conference is connected to the podcast, and now you've introduced the newsletter that has gotten stellar reviews from the likes of Carpathé and whatnot. I feel like you have like a internet bromance with Carpathé almost. Like, you say things about things, no. And then they kind of like, you respond to these things on your own platforms as well. I don't know if you've ever talked directly, but it's fun to observe.
We have. Yeah, we have. I just consider him a mentor, but I mean, he has many, 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 many mentees, and I'm just glad for his support he seems very, very supportive of AI engineering when he doesn't have to. And actually, you know, his personal interests are much more towards foundational ML, which is less of the AI engineering skill set. But still, you know, obviously there's some overlap. I think he's just generally supportive of democratization of AI in any way. And he understands that not everyone will understand ML to the extent that he does, or the extent that, you know, anyone working at a foundation that will do. Doesn't matter. Like, if this is going to impact the wider world and the majority of the population, there will be a range of skill sets and knowledge. And I think he's just generally very supportive of AI engineering there. For as far as like the newsletter is concerned, the reason he likes it is the same reason that the rest of us like it, is because we started off scraping discords. And, you know, there are a lot of AI discords. Every company must have their own AI discord. And there's a tragedy of the commons there, because obviously, like, it's better for Cohere to have a Cohere discord, right? But for me as a AI engineer, like, there's Cohere, but then there's also like 50 other discords that I need to be a part of to understand these things. So basically there's no other solution on the market to aggregate everything into one feed and just browse that. So I was the first one to do it. That's why he likes it.
I think it's super cool. I definitely see the need, and I'm also part of multiple discords, AI related discords. I run Cohere Discord, but I'm also on other ones, Hugging Face and whatnot. And there's like so much conversation happening around those places every day, so it's really hard to wrap your head around it. I took a look at the recap of Cohere Discord yesterday, and I found it really sweet.
Yeah, what do you think?
I found it really sweet. I shared it with the community, actually. I do feel like you are able to extract the most important conversation threads. I feel like sometimes they are presented in a way that is more formal and serious than it's actually in reality. One example would be one user on our Discord was talking about not being able to create emojis with LLMs, I think, right now, like unique emojis. And your newsletter created like an entire paragraph about the pursuit of AI generated unique emojis. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a random comment. Like, somebody just like threw it out there, and then you created this like beautiful summary that looks as if it's like, you know, coming from AI literature or whatnot. So I feel like,
but was it hallucinated? Like, was it factually off?
It wasn't. That's the interesting thing. It wasn't actually off, but the form of delivery was very different from what actually happened. That was super funny.
Okay.
But interesting. But otherwise, I think it was really accurate. So I felt like it's really useful, and I'm definitely going to keep reading when it comes to other discords as well.
Yeah. Thanks. So that thing does point to improvements in summarization, right? Like, so, you know, the general idea of small AI is that, at least for now, I think summarization is a high traffic use case. Like, a lot of people want to do summarization, but they do a very, very poor job of it. Like, they will put in the prompts, please summarize this, and that is the extent of the prompt engineering that they do, three words. And I think, like, for very good summarization, like the ones that you see in the newsletter, there's actually a lot of alpha left in terms of defining what good summarization means beyond the simple blue score, rouge score, you know, the classical NLP type summarization. The stylistic element, like what you described, where, oh, I can very easily identify the failure mode, which is, I did not think about matching the style of conversation or the seriousness of the conversation. That's not something that we prompt for. Like, I just prompt for interestingness, and I provide some few short examples of interestingness. But matching tone, I think, is one element of summarization that I have not explored, that maybe I can expose as an option in future. And I think that's a very interesting dimension. There's a lot of, like, to take summarization seriously, I think I don't think there is a definitive summarization company. And so I think that's something that I'm very interested in, because there's a lot of generative AI, you know, like from a few words to a lot of words. And I think we need to invest in the opposite dimension of a lot of words to few words, from a lot of noise to high signal. And what you identified is basically, even though factually it was correct, it added noise because it blew up something that was very minor. And I think that's something that I need to reflect on as well.
I love that conversation right now because I'm talking to you as the AI engineer and learning how you're approaching this as an AI engineer. I was meant to ask you whether you consider yourself one, but I can tell from how you're talking about how you're structuring the workflow here that you're definitely one. So it's really fun. You're using bots. Let's talk a little bit about the secret sauce to the extent you can talk about it. You're using bots to go and scrape and index information from Discord and from Twitter. Are there any other sources you're plugging into?
Reddit.
Reddit as well. All right.
Yeah. And can you tell me intending to add newsletters, podcasts, and YouTube as well.
Okay. So it's quite comprehensive. That's quite comprehensive. So what's happening underneath? Tell me as much as you can.
I mean, it's a data pipeline. We scrape, we set effectively a cron job to scrape Discord, Reddit, and Twitter. And then 3 times a day, we'll do summaries. The summaries have multi-step processes for them. I think most of them have moved over towards structured output now. It used to be just one prompt, and maybe some of them were multi-stage prompts. I think the Reddit and Twitter ones were multi-stage prompts in a sense of like raw data plus a prompt, and then you get a first cut summary there, and then you refine the summary a few more times by adding some checks. So we have like anti-hallucination checks, we have style checks. So like I have a very specific style that I want to create for information density and for useful links. So for example, in yesterday's Cohere summary, you talked about your sort of chat interface open sourcing on GitHub, and I want the link to appear as part of the summary as well, in the way that I would write it. And I think the way that a lot of developers would write it. And this is actually very good for people reading things in context. I think that's super important. And I think LLMs are underutilized for doing this kind of work. So then ultimately then we're just forming the, after all the summaries are created, then we're composing everything together into the newsletter that you see, and then we're shipping them out. So basically like about, you know, something like 99% of the text is AI generated, but then there's a little bit of human curation in the top level summaries, in a sense that I will generate 3 or 4 candidates for that day's summary, and I as the human will be the judge of the last mile of what gets shipped. So I'm just the sanity check. If there's anything obviously wrong, I'll see it. If there's something that's I haven't defined to be high quality, like, you know, I think there needs to be a flywheel between me observing the final output and then figuring out, okay, why is it that I always consistently choose number 3 instead of number 1 or number 2? Is there something that I haven't really captured in my prompt? And once I have understood that, then I can go back and put it in my prompt, and then everything else down the line will be improved. So I think that human review is very important, and then the human sort of commentary is very important. So I write the title, I write the top half, that I choose the top story of the day, and then everything else is AI generated. I think it's very simple. That's how it is. It has definitely grown a lot, especially after, you know, Andre and Sumit and all the other guys have tweeted publicly about it, saying that they like it. And then for me now, the question is, okay, everyone has the default free tier newsletter. Are people interested in paying for a custom version of it, where you can customize what discords it looks at, you can customize what prompts you use to filter or rank the priorities of certain topics, and if so, then, you know, then we have a then we can make some money. So we're building the custom AI news now. Whenever we ship it, then it'll be the basis of a summarization business, because once we're serving a number of users, we'll be able to start building that data set for more general summarization use cases. And I think the benefit of this is that it's very focused on public information, like semi-public, you know, like Discord is not exactly public, but it's kind of public, you know? I definitely only focus on things that are public channels, right? Like, and anyone can join, and like, it's basically pseudo public. It's just that it's inside of a Discord instead of the public internet. Then Twitter is, of course, is public. Reddit, of course, is public. So I'm just trying to accumulate all these things and serve the community that I have. And from there, develop a core competency in summarization, which I think is an important mission. Like, I think I can work on this. Like, the meta rule for choosing anything that I do is like, can I work on this for 10 years? Maybe. and you know, if I can and still not run out, then probably it's a good direction. Yeah. So that's, I don't know if that's helpful in terms of identifying like the secret sauce, but
I think it's super not helpful. I think it shows kind of the, it illustrates what you've mentioned about UI and UX being really helpful in terms of building the product. So you're shipping a version of it right now and seeing how people respond to it, whether it's useful for them. And then that helps you, that data helps inform future product decisions that might, you know, have a very different interface in the future. But that was really helpful to get this data pipeline to begin with, and get this thing going. Super impressive. I really hope you're going to keep working on it. I think we don't have a good aggregate for what's happening. We have like people trying to aggregate it with their minds, or maybe outsourcing it to interns. I don't know how different AI newsletters work out there, but I can imagine it's a mix of those. But I think automation makes a ton of sense given how much is happening in how many different places and the friction to having to go into particular Discords and going through it and kind of accumulate it in your head. It just wouldn't be healthy for a human being. As I mentioned, it's not good for our health. So it's better to use tools to get better at this.
Yeah, there's two angles here. So one, I call this the content flippening. I did a podcast discussion with the creators of the HN Recap, HN Daily Recap. And I think we're going from a phase where zero of our content was AI generated. Zero of the content that we consume every day is AI generated, and we would like to keep it at zero. And now I think social acceptance has gone up to maybe 5% or 10% AI generated is okay, as long as you know it's high quality. And so for me, I noticed that as soon as the Hacker News Daily Recap podcast appeared, I started listening to it almost every day. And it suddenly became one of my top podcasts. There's also the Papers Read on AI podcast that I listen to that basically just reads papers. It's an auto-generated voice that just reads papers. But the curation is very important. Hacker News is a curation, right? It's a community voting on the top stories of the day. And so I don't really care about the content being AI generated. I care about the curation. And the same thing for the Papers Read on AI. It's some human curating it, but then after that, it's all AI generated. You know, voice 11 Labs stuff. And I think like that is something that where if we can scale content creation and the content curation, I think we'll be more and more acceptance of the fact that, you know, we can actually consume AI generated content and it's still good for us, or it's still better than the human raw alternative, because the human raw alternative is also very noisy. So I'm trying to explore that space basically, but yeah, it can be a little bit uncomfortable for people to know that they're spending so much time with LLM output.
I think it's also about the experience of like having these messages being beautifully crafted, you know, seeing some sort of creativity or originality behind it. And I think you can still do a lot of LLM work on top of it with some human curation, not only when it comes to choosing the version, but also, you know, choosing this paragraph over that paragraph, like being more granular about the number of metaphors, the number of reference links, the overall tone, etc. I think there's a lot of fun work to be done there. I loved our conversation. I let you get back to your stuff. I'm going to link the things that you are working on in the description. Please, guys, check out the AI News. It's really fun. LLM-generated newsletter and also AI Engineer Awards Fair, the best event I've been to. I have my cup, which is my favorite cup right now from that very place. So make sure to sign up for the next edition. Thanks again. Keep in touch.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, you can find me at all socials with @itssandrakublik, and you can find Swix on Twitter primarily, I think, with @SWIX. Thanks a lot for your attention today, and see you on the next episode.